Thank you, Leon. I'm talking about disordered systems and functionalization. This is work I did in collaboration with Pierre-Claude Dussal and for some part with his PhD student Pascal Chauve, both at École Normale Supérieure in Paris. So I will be concerned with models of statistical mechanics. You all learn about that in your classes. Pure systems, we know pretty much about them. For instance, think of a ferromagnet. We even know such details as what happens if we approach the Curie temperature. We know the specific heat diverges. We know that this divergence is a power law. We know how to calculate the exponent, and we can even give the exponent to 3 digits. So this is an incredible success story, but this is also very idealized systems. The question is, what happens if you add disorder to the system? So a little bit of disorder doesn't seem to change much, but what happens if you put strong disorder? This is much less understood. What do I mean by strong disorder? I mean systems where the disorder dominates over entropic effects. There already the question, what is a ground state, is much less clear. So you could decide buy a computer, say you invest $10 to the $6 to get a really nice computer, and you let the computer try to answer that question. For a small system, he will certainly succeed, but if you go to larger systems, your computer will not be able to give you a satisfying answer. And the reason is that he will get trapped in his search for the ground state in so-called metastable states. These are states which are in energy very close to the ground state, but in configurational space, they are very far apart. This comes together with a very slow dynamics. So you have to think a little bit more, and yeah, and a bigger computer is certainly not not an answer. You can also try to make experiments, and you face essentially the same problems. So also, if you have an experiment, your physical system will not be able to find the ground state. So this seems not to be only a technical problem, but some feature of your system. So maybe you should change the way you have to you think about this system. And the question for instance, the ground state is maybe an interesting question, but not the most interesting. There are other questions which are more interesting, which you should better ask. Examples for such systems are glasses. Spin glasses, vortex glasses, electron glasses, structure glasses, I won't talk on this last class, but a random field, magnets, and there are the elastic systems in disorder. I will be mostly concerned with the last class. What is our current understanding of these strongly disordered systems? And it's here where the success story of statistical mechanics comes to an end. Despite 30 years of research, we don't know really much. We have some phenomenological models, and we have some mean field approximation, which involves a technique called RSB. I will come to that later. But it's completely unclear to now whether this applies to any real system. In my talk, I want to talk about recent advances for elastic manifolds in random media. These systems have the advantage that they're approachable by others than these random methods mentioned there. And why still containing all the important ingredients of strongly disordered systems. So let me give you some physical realizations. First of all, you may think of a domain wall in a magnet. if you take a ferromagnet and you cool it below its critical temperature, you will find the phase ordering, and you can prepare the system with one side spin pointing up and one side spin pointing down. So at very low temperature, you will find a domain wall separating these two ordered phases. This domain wall here will try to be as flat as possible due to the elastic energy which it costs to deform a flat surface. It will be flat except if there is disorder. If there is disorder, for instance, a missing spin or a frozen in magnetic moment, this frozen in magnetic moment will try to align the neighboring moments. So in this case, it will be advantageous for the manifold to make a small detour here to take advantage of the energy it can gain by aligning this spin with this one here. Another example will be a contact line of a liquid superfluid helium. You know, superfluid helium likes to wet the surface, so you put a reservoir here. The helium mounts over the surface, and if you have disorder on the surface, there are points which helium would like to wet, and there are other points which it doesn't want to wet. So it will also develop a boundary between the non-wet and the wet phase. You can describe this boundary with a simple height function, u of x, which depends on the position here on the coordinate along the axis x. There is a third system, which is a vortex lattice in a superconductor. So you should think of the vortex lines coming out of the screen here. If you have no disorder, you will have a lattice, a regular lattice here. I should have drawn a triangular lattice, but okay, let's take this lattice here. With disorder, you will have a distortions of the lattice, which I can again parameterize by some displacement field u. So the simplest way to describe, there's a simple model which describes these kind of systems. I told you we have a coordinate, we have a displacement field. The coordinate can in general be d-dimensional. You can have an n-component displacement field. For a domain wall, you will have a one-component displacement field. For the vortex lattice, you will have a two-component displacement field. For a charge density wave, which I didn't draw, you will have a three-component displacement field. You always have an elastic energy, which I take here to be just gradient of u squared. You also have a disorder energy, which well, the disorder potential depends. This is a random variable. It depends on the coordinate and the displacement field u. And I choose it, and this turns out to be what is needed for these systems. I choose it to be short-range correlated in the positions in this coordinate space. So if you have a surface, so this part and the surface and this part, they're subject to some disorder, but they are uncorrelated. It's only if you compare the disorder which is exerted on one or the same part of the membrane, you will have a contribution, and you have a contribution which depends on the how far you have displaced your field. So what are the observables I can measure? There is the roughness exponent. So you ask how, if I have 2 points of my domain wall, for instance, which are some distance x minus x prime apart, how much will typical fluctuations scale? And with these averages, I mean the thermodynamical average and the disorder average here. You can also asked for more complicated observables, the fourth moment, the sixth moment. In fact, you can even ask for the full probability distribution function, and it will turn out that this is very important for these kind of problems, which cannot be described in their moments. You can also ask for observables like the free energy. Now, how do I treat disorder, knowing classical statistical mechanics? In classical statistical mechanics, I always want to calculate things like the free energy. If I have disorder, I have to average this object over disorder. So I have to average the logarithm of the partition function over disorder. How can I do this? The logarithm is a complicated function. I can use a simple trick, which is called the replica trick, and which goes like follows. I can write log z as the limit of n to 0, 1 over n, e to the n log z minus 1. Just to make the Taylor expansion, the first terms cancel, then I have log z. The n cancels, and the next term won't contribute. But this is nothing else than the partition function to the number, to the power of n. And then I take here the limit n to 0. But this is nothing than the n times replicated system. So I take n independent copies, which don't know anything about each other, in the same disorder. And I average this object here over disorder. I want to calculate the average free energy. And this induces me an effective coupling between the copies of my system. So I get a replica Hamiltonian, which contains for each copy elastic energy. And after this averaging, I have an effective interaction between these replicas. And this effective interaction just takes this form. This is the same function I've given you on the last transparency. So now I can start trying to do a perturbation expansion. And people did this about at least 20 years ago. And they worked hard, and at the end of the day, they found something very surprising, which was later turned in a kind of theorem, and which goes like follows. If you have a d-dimensional disordered system at zero temperature, and you calculate in perturbation theory, you find all correlation functions to be equivalent to a pure, so without disorder, system in two dimensions less. Let me give you an example at finite temperature. Let me give you an example. Take the three-dimensional easing model with disorder at zero temperature. This system, due to this equivalence, is equivalent to a one-dimensional pure easing model. So this is what you get out of perturbation theory. I could give you a proof. There's a very nice proof involving supersymmetry. For the elastic manifolds, you can immediately see that on the perturbation expansion, both perturbation expansions are Gaussian. But I don't want to do that because this statement is wrong. This statement is wrong since the three-dimensional disordered easing model has a ferromagnetic phase. Now, this is a statement on the perturbation expansion, so always when you have a... Let's say you have a field theory of these models and... Yeah. So the former one has a an ordered phase, whereas we know from our classes in statistical mechanics that the one-dimensional easing model has no ordered phase. So there is something wrong with that theorem. And I've written in all orders and perturbation theory to indicate to you the correct statement. The two statements that I have to go, I have to do something else than just blind perturbation theory. Let me give you a second example, namely, if we look at these elastic manifolds, you can ask for the roughness exponent, so this second moment of the field U, and you will find that it scales using this rule like x to the 4 minus d. If you have a Chomel correlation function to calculate is x to the 2 minus d, just by power counting. And so here you have a dimension shift by 2, so here you get x to the 4 minus d. This result is also wrong. I come back to that later. In order to understand better what goes wrong, let me introduce you an argument given by Larkin, which goes like follows. It's now on these elastic manifolds I want you to consider. You have here an elastic manifold, and I take out a part of size L. So this part will have volume L to the D. So somehow L to the D, independent degrees of freedom, which each will be subject to some disorder force, and I choose the disorder to be uncorrelated. So the typical force exerted onto these L to the D points will be L to the D over 2, just using the central limit theorem. So you find a typical disorder force which goes like L to the D over 2. And you also have an elastic force which goes like the volume L to the D minus 2. The minus 2 comes from the two gradients in the action, so there's a grad U square. You can balance this. This is balanced at the so-called Larkin length, which is some expression. More important than the actual number there is the fact that if you're in dimension smaller than 4, you can check it here, this order always wins at scales larger than this Larkin length. Whereas in dimension larger than 4, that's not the case. So how can I get out of this dilemma? And a very nice way out of it is given by the function normalization group. And to understand why you need a function normalization group, you only have to tie together the last two arguments I have given you. The first argument given by Larkin says that D equals 4 is the upper critical dimension. So this order is relevant at large scales if you're in dimension smaller than 4. So like in a standard critical phenomena, you would like to make a 4 minus D expansion. On the other hand, dimension reduction, which is wrong in dimension smaller than 4, but which tells you correctly, which is correct in 4 dimensions, tells you that the roughness exponent is 0 in 4 dimensions. This means that the field is marginal, or differently stated, any polynomial of the field has the same power counting dimension. This is a situation which is very different from standard critical phenomena, where in dimension 4, the field has dimension minus 1, so higher powers in the field are always more and more irrelevant. Here all have the same relevance in 4 dimension, so I have to take them somehow all together. And this means I have to take the whole disorder distribution function, I can't just keep the second moment or maybe the fourth moment. I have to take all the whole functional form. I can now use this idea to construct what is called a function normalization group equation. I start from this replica Hamiltonian here, which had the elastic part, the disorder part, which couples two replicas, and I'm interested of how this object changes under renormalization. So when I integrate out the fast degrees of freedom, So in a Wilson scheme, I just take the fastest degrees, I integrate them out. This is indicated by this symbol here. And I have a couple of contributions. The first two are just from my convenience. This is rescaling of R and the field U. The two interesting terms are these here. So this is these terms are quadratic. They are nonlinear and in R. They involve derivatives of my disorder distribution function. So this is a partial nonlinear differential equation for the disorder distribution R.
This equation is derived.
This equation is derived. I can do it. Shall I do it now? This is derived. You have diagrams. This is a disorder. This is replica A and B, and you have you take two of these and you add two correlation functions, which force you these replicas to be the same. The momentum integral is this in phi 4. You have pulled two legs, so you have two derivatives here. So this gives you our second. I call this difference again u of u square. This is the first term, and I have another term where I make the same thing, but one leg is like this, which has a relative combinatorial factor 2 minus 2, a second of 0, a second of u. So this gives the two terms.
So this is a one loop result?
This is a one loop result, which was given by Daniel Fisher in 86.
One loop.
Yeah.
But there's some thing that this is some approximation.
This is a one loop approximation.
Right?
This is one loop approximation. So let me discuss the one loop approximation. So we have this. This is a one loop approximation for this for the true flow of a renormalization of the disorder. What is interesting about this equation is its solution. So you start off with some disorder distribution function which is analytic. So I have chosen here to plot the minus the second derivative of this function. Say you start with something which is a Gaussian here, and then you increase all. So you integrate out the fast degrees of freedom. And at some precise moment, when I hit the Larkin length, this disorder distribution develops a cusp. So this function is no longer analytic here, but has a finite slope. And looks like this, near to zero. And this is somehow the most important feature of this. Of the solution of this equation, because even though I could try to write an equation for the second moment at zero here, this is would give me the two-point correlation function. I just get, you can just do it, derive it twice and set the argument to zero. You just get this trivial result, which is linear, which is exactly the result of dimension reduction. So these terms drop out for the renormalization of the second moment. But this is not the true solution. If I take care of the whole disorder distribution function, my second moment at scales larger than LC is not given by dimension reduction or by this flow equation. At a particular point, not at renormalization scale infinity, at a particular.
When does the one loop approximation break down?
It doesn't break down. It's an approximation. I mean, it's the results which you obtain from the fixed point are correct to order epsilon.
Okay.
like the correct order epsilon in standard 5-4 theory. Maybe you say it's breakdowns if I put epsilon equals 3, but we have no indication that it ever breaks down.
This cusp method causes any problem?
Of course it does.
But it doesn't mean higher order terms become important.
No.
Sorry, when this d minus 4 goes to 0.
Yes.
This fixed point disappears, of course.
Yeah, the fixed point for this R is order 4 minus D.
But some derivative of D is going up.
Yeah, the fourth moment actually becomes infinite. Maybe I should give you the argument why this has to be, why the cusp is necessary.
But what value of this form, this D minus 4 would you like to take at the end of
I can take 1, 2, or 3.
And then the dimensionality is 5, 6, and so on.
I can take 1, 2, or 3, which correspond to 3, 2, or 1. And it works pretty well.
You are
below 4. Let me give you a simple argument why the cusp should be there. So suppose we know that we have a fixed point at order epsilon. And I just my very crude approximation, including only one moment. So I have here some disorder potential, and I've scaled out the amplitude. So this is a result which, so V is independent of epsilon. So the question is, what is the physics beyond the Larkin length? And this is my physical input. The physics is given, has a multiple minima, since now disorder dominates, so there may be a good minima here, and a good minima here. So before I'll see this function as convex, but if I go beyond I'll see, I will have multiple minima. To have that, I necessarily have at least one point where the second derivative of this energy is negative. And in order to be correct for any epsilon, I need necessarily that this, the second derivative of u has an infinite variance. And this is nothing than the fourth derivative of my disorder distribution function at zero. So this argument tells you that the cusp is there, and the cusp is not, can't be avoided. I'm coming to that now. The question is, of course, what happens beyond the one loop? So you have this strange solution at one loop. But of course, if you say this is a systematic perturbation expansion, systematic field theory, you want that you can, at least in principle, calculate higher order corrections. You want this to be a renormalizable field theory, and you want it to make universal predictions. And this, in fact, has been a puzzle.
There is one more thing one should take care of. Are you sure that you expand near the absolute minimum, not near some local minimum? Because you have in replica formulation, in principle, some replica broken solutions sometimes exist. You expand just near the middle. How can one be sure that?
No, no, I don't expand. I expand, since I have the argument u of the function, I make at the same time an expansion about any point on this function. So I expand on about each minima, which is each possible minima, in some sense. I will come to the comparison with replica later, so maybe we can hold that question back. But so this was a problem since 1986. For a simple technical reason, the second order involves the third derivative of this function at zero. So remember that the second derivative had a cusp. So what is the first derivative? I can say this function is symmetric, so I should maybe say this object is zero, or should I take the right-hand derivative or the left-hand derivative, which are the same but differ by sign? In the following, I will show you the solution of this model at second order, of this puzzle at second order, and then I will treat another limit of large number of components, which gives you another control parameter and to play with. So the large n calculation will be exact in epsilon. So at second order, I get the following result. I don't show you the derivation because it's too long for this talk. So the first line is what we know from a first order in epsilon. The second line contains two terms. This term here, which is completely well, which is relatively simply to get, and the second term, which involves the third derivative of my disorder distribution function at zero squared. So I can take either the left-hand derivative or the right-hand derivative here, as long as I square, I have the same term here. The critical question, the difficult question is, how do you get this prefactor here? Or maybe you don't want to have this term at all. So there we have three procedures to fix that coefficient, and they all agree. The first is a technical algorithm, which we call Sloop algorithm. It gives you -1/2. I can't explain the algorithm now. It's too complicated. The second is very physical demand. It's a demand of renormalizability. This is one of the diagrams which appears at the second order. So you have four correlation functions. Here you have a disorder, and you have pulled three legs. So you have the third derivative equally here, and here you have the second derivative. And these, there's one configuration where this is to be taken at zero. This is an ambiguous diagram, but this can be fixed by the demand of renormalizability. If you are familiar with 5-4 theory, you see that this diagram has a subdivergence here. So at second order, there should be a counter term coming from first order, and this counter term is unique and can be used to fix this coefficient, and only with this coefficient the theory is renormalizable. There is a third way to fix it, namely potentiality. If you look at fixed point of this equation for any value other than -1/2, say for instance you start with a periodic potential and you calculate force-force correlation function. So since this is a potential problem, you may calculate the integral of the force over a whole period, and this integral shall be zero. This integral is zero then and only when if you have the correct factor -1/2 here. So this fixes you in three different ways, this coefficient, so I have no doubt about this equation. This, yeah?
I mean, here you set temperature to zero.
Right? Yeah, zero temperature.
The temperature is going to zero, really. That cusp is rounded.
I think of a t equals zero problem.
I'm just wondering how, as temperature is going to zero, how do you get this result with zero plus? If you round
this is
by temperature, then the third derivative is zero.
Yeah, okay, then it's more complicated. You need to t times r4th of zero, which somehow plays the same role as r3rd of the zero squared here. But, I mean, this is really too technical to discuss more here. And you have to really to see how the boundary layer develops and stuff like that. So let's not discuss that here. So you have three different physical situation, and you have three different fixed points. You can start off with a periodic potential, then you the solution will of course remain periodic. You can calculate a universal amplitude. You can have the situation of a random field disorder or random bond disorder, and you get two different predictions. And just if you want to see that this works numerically, I've given you here some numerical simulations. Maybe the most most unfavorable for an epsilon expansion is to put epsilon equals 3, so to one dimension. This is a directed polymer, and this system is equivalent to the KPZ equation. In this case, since we have one component in one dimension, and we know exactly that the exponent is 2/3. So at our epsilon squared, we get something which is pretty close to that. And I should say that this is the only field theory which is capable of attacking the strong coupling fixed point. If you work really in the KPZ framework, all your attempts to use the field theory fail.
Sorry, before you get on, in the last transparency, you have cases with the membrane bond and random.
Yes.
The relationship with the membrane bond?
So this is whether the force-force correlation or the potential-potential correlation of your initial model of your bare potential are short-range correlated. So let me go to large N now, which is another way of controlling this, which is another control parameter. So I would like to be exact now in epsilon equals 4 minus d, but I introduce a model with N components.
Sorry, before you leave there, so the two loop, what happens to the cusp?
The cusp is still there and has the same form. Just the coefficients changed by order epsilon squared terms. So now let me address a large N. And I start from a model which is a very similar. I have, again, an elastic energy. I now put an explicit infrared cutoff. I have the disorder correlator. I now call it B. Before, I had a function which depended only on U, but this was a one-component case. So now I want to preserve rotation invariance, so I use a function B of U squared. So this is the disorder correlator. And I put an explicit source here, which pulls which couples to the replicas, and then I go through the usual calculation. I calculate the free energy given the source. I make a Legendre transform. I get the effective action, and then I solve the subtle point equations at large N. And what I find is, and this is a quite surprising result, is that there is a closed equation for the second cumulant. So I made some, I could have added the third cumulant for my disorder, then this would be the most general model I could ever write down. But it turns out that in the limit of large N, this is large N strictly infinity, these equations decouple. So it's the only one settle point equation for the second cumulant, which I like to explain now. So B is the bare disorder. B prime means the derivative, and B tilde is a renormalized disorder, which depends on my renormalization scale M. So I start out with renormalized disorder equals bare disorder at a mass which is comparable to the ultraviolet cutoff, and then I lower this mass, and I obtain that the renormalized disorder, so the, its derivative, is given by the bare disorder with some shift argument. I have one shift proportional to temperature, and I have a second shift proportional to the renormalized disorder itself. So this is a complicated coupled equation, and I now want to solve that. If you want, you can also, if you prefer thinking in a graphical interpretation, what this equation resums are all tree-like diagrams like this at t equals 0, where the branches of a tree are given by by the integral I2. So we have a square here in the denominator. So I really have to solve this equation now. And we found a way to solve it exactly. And this involves two steps. The first step is we turn this into a function realization group equation. So we take this saddle point equation, derive it with respect to our scale M. We get the following equation, of which the one loop part is the same as that one obtained by Balance and Fisher at one loop order. But this result is correct to all orders in epsilon. In fact, it's exact in epsilon. And we can solve this partial nonlinear differential equation. And at the first glance, it looks pretty undoable. But you can go to the differential equation of the inverse function. And the differential equation of the inverse function is linear. And with some hard work, you can solve this complicated linear differential equation. Let me only discuss the results. So first, if you start with long-range disorder, you find a roughness exponent epsilon over 2 times 1 plus gamma, which is actually the same as the one found by Balance and Fisher at order epsilon, and by Mesa and Parisi in a replica symmetry broken scheme. I come to that in a minute.
What's gamma?
Gamma is that the decay of the Bayer disorder. Since we have an explicit analytic solution, we can also see very nicely how the cusp forms. We can see that as long as we have M larger than MC, the disorder, the renormalized disorder is analytic, dimensional reduction holds. But as far as we are beyond MC, this is no longer the case. We have a cusp, and dimensional reduction is wrong. And the disorder after the cusp, it still moves slightly, and then it flows to its fixed point. So this is an explicit solution. Though there's not much more to add to large N. The question you will probably ask is, what is the relation to replica symmetry breaking, and to what other people have done in using a Gaussian variation ansatz, which is supposed, this is a declaration of these authors, that it's also be exact at large N. So I'm now referring to what Mesa and Parisi did for the same model with some slight, but it will turn out important difference. So they don't put a background, they don't put a source, they work at source zero, and they study then the same model as we did. They make a Gaussian variational ansatz, so they approximate this by a quadratic action. So the most general quadratic action you can write down is this, with some metric sigma AB. You have then to solve this equation. And the simplest solution is to suppose that all sigma AB are equal. They are sigma. And this ansatz leads to the results given by dimensional reduction. So this is correct before the Larkin length, but not beyond. The idea, the ingenious idea, was then to say, OK, let's not take all the sigma AB equal. Take them different in some way. So I have the matrix of couplings here, and I half them. I take one coupling in this corner, another coupling in that corner, and something else in the remaining blocks. In the remaining blocks, I repeat this procedure. So I take some coupling here, some coupling here. I'd rather I take the same coupling here and here. And then I do something else here, and there I stop because I can't draw any longer. So you find if you do this and you add one more step in this procedure, your results get better and better. And it seems to get more hopeless and more hopeless to solve that. This was really the ingenious idea of Parisi. He found a way to parametrize the whole complicated hierarchical matrix sigma AB by some function sigma of U, where U takes values between 0 and 1. U is a Parisi parameter or overlap. It has a very natural explanation in spin glasses. So in spin glasses, this is nothing than the correlation function between two copies. So either you have a spin spins which are close, so then they will be correlated. So this will correspond to U where U is close to 1, or you will have copies which are far away, so which are uncorrelated. So in some sense, U equals 0 are the distant states, and U equals 1 are the nearby states. You have also then to solve some saddle point equations, which I dropped, and you get some solution. The solution is a curve. The important thing to learn here is that having calculated this function sigma of U, there's a well-defined procedure, you can reconstruct the two-point function as an integral over this function sigma of U. So this is a well-defined procedure. The question is there any relation at all between what the function normalization group and the replica symmetry breaking do? And this is a quite subtle point. There is a relation, but in order to understand whether there is a relation or why should there be a relation, we have to think carefully of how we did the calculation. So in the function normalization group, I told you, we add a source to our system and then calculate the complete disorder distribution function. So we calculate the disorder distribution function given some distance, some displacement of our field. No, some finite. R of U, the U is finite. I put some finite source, and I calculate the effective action, which is the disorder distribution function, given some constant and finite background field. This is really finite. What Meza and Parisi did, they calculate at source zero, so at zero background field. So these are, in principle, they are different calculations. So if I can compare, I have to calculate with a source, but then I have to relax the condition of the source. So I have to put my background field to zero. But remember what happens if I do that in a ferromagnet. In a ferromagnet, if I put in a magnetic field, I will direct the magnet, and even if I relax the condition, I still have the symmetry breaking. I have explicit symmetry breaking, which I put by hand. So the function normalization group has a strong explicit symmetry breaking. The Parisi method, on the other hand, has spontaneous replica symmetry breaking. So if I can hope to compare, I should be able to compare the value given by RSB, where I have the most possible spontaneous symmetry breaking. And this is given by this Parisi function at Parisi value 0. Remember, I told you this has the interpretation of a correlation function in the SK model. So this is the overlap. So sigma of 0 are the states which are the far apart is possible. So what we found is that the function normalization group gives you the contribution to the two-point function calculated by Meza and Parisi, and exactly that part here. So the contribution by the distant states. It doesn't give you the contribution by the nearby states. But I don't expect to get this contribution. So probably you would say, okay, again, it stops here. We can't do more. But in fact, we can do more. And I found this quite amusing, so let me explain to you. We can, in fact, reconstruct the whole two-point function given by Mézard and Parisi without ever inverting any replica matrix. To understand how this works, we have to look a little bit more carefully at this curve, which is calculated by Mézard and Parisi. So this has a flat part here, which is given by the infrared properties, and this is the part which is calculated by functionalization group. And this is blue part here, which is determined by the ultraviolet properties of the system. And then there is the green part. So we thought, okay, let's try a Ramization group on Mézard-Parisi, just calculate the Ramization of this green part. And then we found to our surprise, and this seems to be quite general, that they are independent on scale. But this is great. Now I can just vary my scale here, and I can scan. I can scan this whole green curve. By scanning this whole green curve, I can reconstruct the whole Mézard-Parisi function as a function of the object which the functionalization group calculates. So the non-trivial thing is that I get correctly that here, and the rest is just at looking a little bit at the replica symmetry broken things. I have no good a priori argument. It seems this is a general general feature, but so I don't know how patient you are. I still have something to tell you about the dynamics.
So this is an argument that the replica symmetry solution is it meaningful or is it correct? What do we know about what the difference is? That's controversial.
No, we have replica symmetry breaking in our scheme, in some sense. We have explicit replica symmetry breaking.
Break it explicitly, no. But I'm saying, would you regard this as an argument that the replica symmetry breaking method is a good method to follow for the disordered system? For example, does this tell me that what would I expect in a two-dimensional system?
I mean, I haven't. Our analysis gives no hints, no doubt on the correctness of the replica symmetry breaking scheme or method. The question you ask, whether it is a good method, there might have more doubt because people like De Dominicis, they try since many years to go away from that limit. This is the only limit they can treat. Whereas the functionalization group, as you have seen, is capable of not only addressing the limit of large n. And it seems hopeless.
I'm asking really, I'm asking.
Okay.
Just the it's correct to say, however, the implication here, in one case where you can compare it with the method you prefer, you get a work. Right?
Yeah. I mean, we get the same. Same end. And there's some end where these methods match perfectly.
Now, of course, the Parisi philosophy going along with it has a whole interpretation of that symmetry breaking. Does your approach lead to the same interpretation? Can you interpret what it means by now as a different
state?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly metastable states. I mean, also the argument I gave you was the fourth moment of R should be infinite. It uses in principle the same. It uses the fact there are more than one ground state.
I mean, you know, forgetting about replicas, just the function relationship. Can you give a similar interpretation of the result? So it's the cusp that somehow is known with a large number of random steps.
Yeah. I can do the whole thing if I want to without using replicas. I can do a dynamic formulation. Just a technical convenience to use replicas.
I mean, it's probably fair to point out that, okay, so in this case, this replica symmetry breaking and this variational thing works, but in 2D, for example, it doesn't work. Right? It gives you the wrong answer. At least roughly.
You can do as large anything.
Is that an equivalent for to leading order in one of
the give you?
So the infinite end limit is.
I mean, the infinite end limit is. Do you have a system you can give me which has infinite n? A physical system? So, but we are discussing about finite n. So, and my point is that the replica method is good at infinite n, but it's not clear whether finite n is the same physics as infinite n. And this question should be addressed by 1 over n calculation. The 1 over n calculation seems to be after 20 years of research by people as strong as De Dominis, not to lead to any predictive results.
But I mean, it also doesn't give you the super log phase, right?
Okay.
I have a question. You have three fixed points in your tree, right? So this is the state where you don't have anything.
I mean, the theory is always the same. It's your starting disorder which is different.
So it's just that the final distribution is different.
Yeah, because the initial distribution is different.
You calculate the 1 over n contribution?
Yes. We have calculated the corrections to the effective action at order 1 over n. You can calculate a beta function, and it was 4 pages in mathematical output, so I don't want to show you. We still need some time to interpret that. But I'm sure we will. Yeah, there are a couple of problems, but I think we will succeed in interpreting this formidable equation at some point. Yeah, I think. So, let me conclude. So we have developed methods of the functionalization group, which work at second order in perturbation theory. We need new anomalous terms, and we get a bunch of numerical verifiable and verified results. I didn't have the time to tell you about the dynamics. You can also study systems, for instance, a domain wall, and if you apply a magnetic field, you drive the domain wall for your systems. This is a different universality class with its own the physics and its own problems. You can also treat that at second order. At n equals infinity, we have a complete solution of the renormalized disorder as a function of the scale. We can analytically treat the cusp formation. We have a precise relation to the replica symmetry breaking method. At order 1 over n, I was already mentioning, we can calculate the correction to the disorder. This is a formidable expression. We can calculate the beta function. As I told you, this equation is very long, and we still need some interpretation. We also have application to dynamics, random field problems, in progress, but this will, I hope I can tell you about that another time. So thank you for your attention.